The racy title, Missionary Has No Clothes. Yep. I subtitled it. I didn't have it in this chapter, but I thought about it yesterday to attract more people here. Obviously, it did the opposite. People were offended, and no, I'm just kidding. Just the last day of class syndrome. But anyway, here it is. In one of the earlier critiques of the emerging church, Michael Horton commented that postmodernism is the new code word for mission. Now, that's an odd way to say it. Maybe he meant something different. Maybe he meant the same thing. I don't know, but I think for a lot of us over the last decade who, A, love biblical doctrine, and B, have been planting churches since the emergent church has shown up, have come to understand the reverse, that it's mission that's become a code word for postmodernism. And more often than not, the critical material only applies to kids who have grown up in the church, in fundamentalist households, who were oblivious to the reality of pluralism when they read these books, and so the corrections are of limited value outside those circles. Anyway, what is this word missional that's been getting thrown around so much in the last decade? Let's get right into it, this thing called missiology. It actually is a legitimate term in theology. It might not be a chapter or a big chapter in systematic theology textbooks. The basic definition of missiology is just the study of missions, straightforward. And it occupies very little time and arouses little interest among students of systematic theology, or at least that used to be the case. And perhaps that's because within the West, this doctrine of mission had been reduced, or really our whole concept of mission in the church, had become reduced to the study of the brave soul that the local church slaps on the back and sends off to Zimbabwe, does all the stuff that we're really too gutless to do. So the whole practice of mission had been reductionistic. And so the modern church is really conceived of two classes of people in the church, one being the sender and one who is the sent. And within that framework, the church has been conceived as exclusively the sender. So 99% of the people, those are the senders, and then that one guy, he's the sent, he's the missionary. And this is now regarded to have been completely wrong-headed, and I would wholeheartedly agree to that criticism. I think that's the good part about missional theology, and I think, without too much overstatement, I'm going to suggest that that's probably the only thing good to it, and other people could have told us that and did. And you have to be very careful when somebody's telling you something that's true to see who's doing it and all the, what politicians call, pork that's added onto the bill. The reason that there's a missional theology is not because anybody is consciously placing the doctrine of the church above the doctrine of God, but because they point out that mission is actually a part of the doctrine of God because of who He is, when you think about it. So here's what I mean by that. I have up on the board, first of all, the meaning of mission in the Latin missio, and which comes from the more, and the Catholic Mass comes from this, and at the end, traditionally, this missae was said, which basically at the end, he dismisses you, dismiss. Eo, I send you. And that's where the word mission comes from in the English. And what we have here is, on the board, a right view, I'm going to suggest, about theology being above missiology, for hopefully obvious reasons, and then within the doctrine of God, I'm going to make a distinction between A, God in Himself, and B, God in relation. Basic creation distinction maintained by seeing God in Himself before you see God even as the Creator. So God in Himself, which is necessary per se, and then God in relation, which we're going to see is something Calvin called a consequent necessity. And I think that's what missional theology is really making this big mistake about. When we talk about the mission of God, the Missio Dei, we're first and foremost saying that God Himself is on the move, that He is both sender and sent. So when the church has been making this mistake, the missiologists now tell us, it's because they've been making a fundamental mistake of who God is. God is both sender and sent. God is sending on mission because He sent the Son. And then the Son sent the Spirit. God is also sent because the Christ who is sent is God. And so is the Spirit who is sent. So this sending and sent is very Trinitarian. It's God Himself. And it was the resurrected Jesus who said to the disciples in John chapter 20, verse 21, and here's the first linchpin text of missional theology. I'll collect all these different important texts to them. Here's the first, John 20, 21. Jesus is saying to the disciples, as the Father has sent me, even so I am sending you. Mission. So in the same way that Jesus was sent, think of John 1:14, the Word became flesh. John 3:16, God so loved the world that He sent, gave His only begotten Son. Mark 10:45, there's another mission statement. Even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. He's sent as a servant. In that way, we are sent and are to put on flesh into culture. You hear that word all the time, incarnational as a description. We'll get to it. Well, one preliminary question we might want to ask these missiologists is whether or not this attribute of God has not been exalted above some others, or else not carefully enough qualified with respect to the others. Might also want to ask whether or not the mission of God is not a divine attribute of the sort that Calvin meant when he called these a necessary consequence. So that's that B, 1B, theology, but even in theology, it's theology in relation. Not God in himself, but God in relation to things that he's made. Necessary consequence. Here's what Calvin meant by that. On the one hand, and Calvin was talking about salvation, doing the atonement the way he did it. God was free to refuse redemption to a sinful race. In other words, redemption is not necessary to a holy God. He was free to refuse salvation. However, given that he did decree to redeem sinners, because he is faithful in himself, for example, that particular redemption found in Christ was the only way to do it, the substitutionary atonement and so on. That was necessary given his decree. The atonement was necessary as a condition for this thing called salvation, which salvation in turn was not necessary to the divine nature per se. So, God was free to not save. He was free not to create to begin with. But if he was going to create, he had to do it in a way that glorifies himself. If he was going to redeem, he had to do it in a way that honored his own glory, and so on. A necessary consequent. Necessary in that way, as a consequent of what he freely did. You see the same sound logic in John Stott's contemporary classic, The Cross of Christ, in which he rightly points out that if God is going to reconcile sinners, he must do so in a way that does not violate himself. I'm paraphrasing there. But what Calvin and what Stott were saying about the work of Christ is nothing more or less than a necessary corollary of theism. If you're a monotheist at all, you have to break theology down that way. And which doesn't mean that you have to write it on the board like that and use those words. I just mean you have to mean it that way. To the degree that we don't, we're not consistent theists. The moment that we define an essential nature of God, an essential attribute of God, in other words, the moment we start our theology from anything that is contingent upon the essential divine nature, we have officially, at that point, erased the creator-creation distinction and abandoned the theistic worldview. And for this reason, the missiologists, in order to remain orthodox, have to keep in mind that the mission of God is a necessarily consequential attribute of God that ought to be informed by those antecedent necessary attributes such as He is in Himself. In other words, God in relation, Creator, Redeemer, sent on mission, has to be understood in relation to God in Himself. That He's holy, that He's infinite, and so on and so forth. Now, sometimes the trouble is not necessarily somebody who's thinking about this wrongly, explicitly. Oftentimes, it's nothing more than a statement that is left too vacuous. The assumptions might be wrong, or they might not. You could go deeper, and you probably should for the sake of charity. But you also know very well that most readers, most people at the practical church planting level, missiologists on mission, are probably not going to probe things as they should and are going to be operating with the basest of assumptions. Take the following summary definitions of missional by a guy named Dan Kimball in a book called They Like Jesus, But Not the Church, which already makes me want to put up a billboard that says, if you hate church, you'll really hate us. Just to get under people's skin. But anyway, listen to these three. Now, the rest of what he says about being missional, he rails off about 12 of these. I actually don't mind some of the other ones. These are three that you could even smooth out these three things and make them orthodox. But let's just see what's going on, the morphology going on, the equivocation going on. Three things that missional means to Dan Kimball. He says this, being missional means we see the church not as a place we go only on Sunday, but as something we are throughout the week. Okay, I'm part of the church the whole week, I'll buy that. Being missional, he continues, means that we understand that we don't bring Jesus to people, but we realize Jesus is active in culture, and we join him in what he's doing. Okay, Jesus is active in culture, and I can't bring Jesus around. Like, what is he, like in a Petri dish? Okay, I'll buy that too. Okay. Thirdly, being missional means serving our communities and that we build relationships with the people in them rather than seeing them as an evangelistic target. Okay, what do you mean? Okay. So like I said, the rest of the definitions offered by Kimball, no problem with. And there's a way I can even say these three things that are perfectly biblical. But let's just take that first one first. Being missional means we see the church not as a place we go only on Sunday, but as something we are throughout the week. If we begin with the assumption that the church is primarily the community in relationship to the culture, and only secondarily the, quote, meeting place, as it's fashionable, you know, to call the corporate gathering on the Lord's Day, then that first sentence takes on unbiblical connotations. You've decentralized, defused, dechurched, deassembled the church, which is a contradiction in terms, because ecclesia means assembly. Second statement, being missional means we understand we don't bring Jesus to people, but we realize Jesus is active in culture. We join him in what he's doing. If we begin with the assumption that Jesus was a missional example, let's ignore that similarity of that phrase to the 19th century version of the same thing. A missional example, more than he came to bear witness to the truth, more than he came ultimately to die and to rise for sinners, then that second sentence becomes a pretext for a social gospel. Third statement, serving our communities, build relationships with people, not see them as evangelistic targets. Well, if I use the word mere before the words evangelistic targets, I can see that. But why do we have to choose between relating to people in ordinary ways, human ways, not being a jerk, and being intentional about sharing the gospel with them? Are we assuming up front that sharing the gospel is either done more effectively or more appropriately by example rather than by words? Or that it's better communicated by accident rather than by design? By the way, if you think, and as we're going to see, this is emergent versus missional, the leaders of the missional movement, conservative, an example of this is Driscoll's statement, the story he told one time about the Jehovah's Witnesses coming to his door. And he didn't want to have that conversation. He didn't want to give them any credibility. Why? Not because what they were saying was false, but because, who are these guys? I don't have any relationship with you. I'm sorry, but I've got plenty of relationship with plenty of people who, if I believed what they said, would send me straight to hell. Why is that? How did that become primary? You see the common ground here. Now, there's a good start by a couple of guys, Kevin DeYoung and Greg Gilbert, who wrote a book that started to ask some questions here. And I think it's a good start. I think you got to go further, but it's a good start. Because pointing out chinks in the emerging armor is fair game today. You can criticize the emerging church if what you mean by that is the emergent church. But who will dare to criticize anything missional today? Well, the most specific book on record so far is one put up by Crossway 2 years ago now by Kevin DeYoung and Greg Gilbert. It's called What is the Mission of the Church? I would advise you, recommend to you, especially if you're young and thinking about church planting. I think if we're planting churches, I think our church planters have got to get this book on their shelf. DeYoung and Gilbert's book, What is the Mission of the Church? They say this, because mission is not a biblical word like covenant or justification or gospel, determining its meaning for believers is particularly difficult. That is a great start to the book. But it really strikes at the heart of what so often their criticisms are. These missional guys are convinced, with the N.T. Wrights and Peter Lighthearts of the world, They're convinced that the object of their attack is extra-biblical. So I love that start by DeYoung and Gilbert. Because mission is not a biblical word, like covenant or justification or gospel, determining its meaning for believers is particularly difficult. Why is that important? Well, if that's the start of your theology, that's the name of your theology, and it's not a biblical word, you've got some questions to answer. Doesn't prove everything right off the top, but you've got some questions to answer. So, it's a legitimate controlling category of sorts. I will admit that. Mission. We've already seen that. God sent His Son, the Son sends the Spirit, and out of that divine purpose, the church is sent. That's a legitimate controlling category up to a point. It's a legitimate biblical circle to draw. But that theology begs the question, sent for what? There's got to be bigger circles than that. So DeYoung and Gilbert say, quote, "What if the work of salvation, restoration, and recreation are divine gifts to which we bear witness, rather than works in which we collaborate?" So you remember Todd Hunter back in that chapter when I talked about that. This is not a story about an angry God beating up His Son. It's about us being friends with Jesus, cooperative friends on His mission. But DeYoung and Gilbert rightly ask, what if the work of salvation, restoration, and recreation are divine gifts to which we bear witness rather than works in which we collaborate? What if our mission is not identical to God's mission? What if we carry on Jesus' mission, but not in the same way He carried it out? It's Christianity 101, guys. Right? I mean, yes, as the Father has sent me, so I send you. In this sense, not in every sense. You're not dying and rising for people. You don't point to yourself. But there's only one acceptable answer to their question today. We are sent into culture on the same mission Jesus was on, doing justice within gospel community. This begs a few questions, though. Foremost is what exactly the church is sent to do, or to ask it another way, what is the Great Commission? Now, the missional crowd bucks at asking it this way. For them, that is reductionistic. For starters, approaching the Bible in a narrative, not systematic way, we've already covered that, they give a priority to Genesis 12, 1 through 3. So let's write that one up there. Another linchpin text. Genesis 12, 1 through 3. And you particularly can find this in Christopher Wright's book, The Mission of God. And that priority interprets Abraham's calling as a, quote, moral agenda for God's people, as well as a mission statement by God. A moral agenda for God's people, as well as a mission statement by God. Now, DeYoung and Gilbert respond to this, quote, "Even if Abraham is told, 'Go, be a blessing,' the entire story of the patriarchs demonstrates that God is the one doing the blessing, quite apart from any blessing strategy on the part of Abraham." By the way, was Abraham a blessing to Abimelech? Yes. Or Isaac? I mean, come on! This is Christianity 101. A secondary priority is given to Exodus 19, 5 and 6. And this one happens to come from a book by Reggie McNeil, another one of their authors. And he's basically talking about the fact that God intends to make His people a priesthood, which makes the church intermediaries. You might even use the phrase vicar of Christ, but you wouldn't because he'd sound too Catholic. Intermediaries, or as McNeil put it, quote, "a people to serve as His ongoing incarnational presence on earth." Okay, but how so? The bottom line is that the consequences do not merely extend to our definition of the kingdom, but of our definition of the gospel. If you redefine the kingdom to where you're not sure who the king is, or if you are, that he's an example and you're to follow that in total, you've got a different gospel immediately. Your definition of the kingdom and Christ as example, that will bleed immediately, not one day, it'll bleed immediately into the gospel. The failure to say so by evangelical leaders is a loss of nerve. The failure of Calvinist leaders who rub shoulders with missional leaders is a loss of nerve. Notice the kind of things one must expose in contrasting the missional kingdom with the biblical kingdom. One is hard-pressed, when criticizing them, to avoid making a case against the original liberalism, the original social gospel. Final linchpin text is Luke 4, 16 through 21. And you remember that, where Jesus is preaching in the synagogue saying that the prophecy from Isaiah 61 is being fulfilled. So, in verse 18 of Luke 4, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because He has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed. Not hard to predict how the entire emerging generation is going to read that verse. They're going to read it like a bunch of Marxists. It's another liberation theology, except that unlike in the 1800s and in the 1960s, the oppressive kingdom of this age is a much more comprehensive circle of Western civilization. Nothing Western now, nothing objective, is to survive this scorched earth policy of the liberation Jesus. DeYoung and Gilbert show that this is a classic case of missing the trees for the forest. That this ministry of Jesus was one of proclaiming, read the words, so that these are, they say, these are all words that point to speaking. Spirit of the Lord's upon me so that I can proclaim this, announce this, say this, set these chains off by saying something. When it comes to the link between the gospel and the mission, there's some basic who, what, when, where, why, how, and to whom questions that need to be asked that haven't been asked. And behind this are two competing eschatologies. And what I mean by that is not end times per se, I just mean about the nature of the kingdom. What is the kingdom in traditional Christianity versus this form of Christianity? It's difficult to completely divorce the emerging kingdom from the old liberal versions, where the church ushers in the kingdom via culture. Yet, as DeYoung and Gilbert say, quote, the verbs associated with the kingdom, in other words, the real kingdom, the biblical kingdom, are almost always passive. Enter, receive, inherit, end quote. That correction does not marginalize either good deeds or cultural engagement, but what it does do is to place the gospel as the DNA of the kingdom and the Christian's cultural influence as the effect of that life. So we'll draw out our doctrine of the kingdom of God in the, I was putting this in the final chapter, but here's what I can say so far about the kingdom of God that I think is different than this emerging view of the kingdom of God. And in this sense, it's no different than our view, than what Machen was saying against traditional liberal theology. The real kingdom of Christ is, first of all, flows this way. The reign and rule of God goes, number one, from the invisible to the visible. It's words. Two, relational over geographical. And by relational, I mean God, the Trinitarian God, reconciling people to Christ, and therefore it spreads. Thirdly, redemptive to restorative, against N.T. Wright. And a right version of Romans 8 places Romans 8 in the context of the rest of Romans, where God's reconciling people through Christ to Himself, and then through that, and in the end, restoring creation. And then fourthly, covenantal to universal. So you have to ask, what covenant are we talking about? Is Christ at the head of His race in a special sense in which He's head of the whole creation? Talked about that in the sermon a couple weeks ago. So that's the real kingdom of God. It's not enough to say that the kingdom is manifest to the world in the church. Catholic Church said that. Liberal theology originally said that. We have to say that the kingdom is manifest in the announcement of the judgment and mercy of Christ. That's what Jesus meant in Luke 4. The witness to the kingdom, the witness to the gospel, is propositional before it's communal. The object of its announcement is Christ-centered, not church-centered. What are the foundations of missional theology beyond just, you know, that meaning of missio and these linchpin texts? What's really going on? How did it start historically? Well, many people in the movement trace these thoughts back to the work of Roland Allen and Leslie Nugent, both of whom questioned the West's really compartmentalized approach to missions. And they were right about that. Again, missiology is not just the dude we throw that way and then we're the senders, but we're not sent. They were right in that criticism. Roland Allen's important book in 1912, Missionary Methods, St. Paul's or Ours, was instrumental in the beginning of the critique of imperialistic mission. Or, the right way to say it, the wrong-headed attempt to westernize indigenous populations with our missionary efforts. That was wrong to do, but what do we mean by that? Instead, we ought to do what Paul himself did. Train up those within the local culture, indigenous churches, indigenous elders, their translations of the Bible and so on, to express the Christian faith in a way intelligible to that culture. But that you can easily see where these people would take that criticism off the reservation in post-colonial, which is really just Marxism in church, ways of criticizing Western culture. Leslie Newbegin, again, tons of books about pluralism, the gospel, and culture, and contextualization that forms the foundation for this. But at the end of the day, by the time you reach the end of the 1990s, the beginning of the emerging church, here's the end formula. And I'm going to put this on the board, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to compare how classical Christianity versus the emergent church would answer these questions or would understand these statements. And I'm going to show the missional church in the middle between them to show you just how much missional theology is going to slide right into the emerging theology. So classical on the left, missional in the center, that's where I want to position them here to show you the slide, and emergent, and ignore the fact the counterintuitive imagery of the emergent being on the right and classical being on the left, so some kind of political spectrum. Ignore that. That's not the point here. I just mean it as a historical process. And these are the three parts of this formula, and I'll show you, and this will show you how the ideas can be parsed out and how they are. The first issue is this, and I haven't given myself room on the left. I'll put it all the way on the right, the question. The first issue is a proposition. It's human culture is temporary. That's our first premise. Human culture is temporary. All right. I think every one of these views will say check, check, check. All three views will say yes, human culture is temporary. Watch the morphing and the equivocation after that. Second point, worldview is a product of culture. So I'll put an arrow down from culture, worldview, product of culture. Emergent church, yep. Missional church, yep. Traditional Christianity would ask, what do you mean by that? What do you mean, worldview? How much of our worldview? Everything we think purely product of human culture? Well, what do you mean? So I'm going to put a question mark there and a choose your own adventure based on what you mean by that. The classical Christian would say, wait a minute, what do you mean by that? I smell a Marxist. Thirdly, therefore, the gospel, it's another premise. The gospel stands above every culture. So the gospel stands above every human culture. Classical Christian is going to say, absolutely. Missional conservative church is going to say, yes, absolutely. We're conservative, Calvinist, and so on. The emergent church is going to say, no, I'm going to put an X there. Okay? So what the difference starts to become this. Whereas Brian McLaren would say about a trans worldview gospel, no. He would recognize any eternal idea. The gospel is eternal, timeless, over every, no way. And if you have that idea, it has no right to impose itself on other cultures. So the missional church thinks they're going to be separate from the emergent church on this point. They do believe with us in an eternal, timeless gospel that stands over culture, but watch what's happening. In that second issue, they've already defined worldview as entirely a product of human culture. And that is going to slide right down into this, and I'll explain how that is. Consequently, as a result of these three premises, notice in the missional board, check, check, check. Human culture temporary, worldview a product of culture, but the gospel stands over every culture, therefore it stands over every worldview. The gospel, in other words, cannot be reduced to a worldview. Do you see the conclusion from those premises? The gospel cannot be reduced to a worldview, as, for instance, a Western propositional worldview. So by the time you get to the practical church planting material, the methodology, there's an unspoken or uncritically accepted assumption. And the assumption is this, that the gospel that stands between the extremes of compromising liberalism and inwardly driven fundamentalism, that timeless gospel is a trans-worldview gospel in character. In other words, this missiology is beginning to train us and to train a generation of church planters who are the new Calvinists in every community, sucking all the 20s and 30s into cooler, you get the idea, the assumption that the concept of worldview is also just another cultural concept. And this will only further scratch our itch against the idea of systematic theology, against objectivity. Worldviews, after all, are also culturally expressed. And so if the gospel is to transcend all human cultures, then it must also transcend worldviews. And hence the missionary asks the very necessary question, what worldview is dominant with this tribe that I'm going into? It's not exactly the same sort of question as other ones that he has to ask. What language do they speak? What mannerisms do they live by? Those three concepts, ultimate worldview foundations, linguistic constructs, cultural mannerisms, are obviously on different points on a spectrum of permanence to transition. The Christian missionary who does not see this might be effective as a missionary. Whether he will remain Christian throughout his mission might be another matter. Language and mannerisms emerge as the gradual exchange of cultural expressions. The fact that worldviews do the same does not mean that some of their elements, for example, the laws of logic, the number one, that some of their reflections are not eternal truths. By treating gospel as a universal, apart from a universal worldview, we receive the impression that when a fundamentalist argues over soteriology, he doesn't, he argues over secondary issues, card trick. When a fundamentalist argues over soteriology, he's committing the same basic error as when he argues over the color of the carpet. There's a postmodern assumption behind that coupling. There's a neo-Marxist post-colonial assumption behind that coupling. So before we're ready to divorce the emergent from the emerging too cleanly, consider this statement by Brian McLaren and ask what the more conservative pastors and planters might be taking for granted about starting points and where they lead. McLaren says this, quote, "Rather than seeing missiology as a study within theology, theology is actually a discipline within Christian mission. Theology is the church on a mission reflecting on its message, its identity, its mission." The same thing as that original board. So what happens when theology is the church on mission reflecting on its mission, its message, its identity, its meaning? The answer is that they begin to reflect themselves, and the kingdom becomes king. We've seen that with the new liberalism. It makes the same basic mistake as the old liberalism when it comes to the practical endgame of cultural accommodation. But we might be assuming that accommodation is only ever a matter of practice. One of the dirty little secrets here is that both the modern guy and the postmodern guy can resort to a brand of pragmatism. Remember, pragmatism is just, if it works, do it. If it works, it's true. Works for what? That's classical philosophy. If it works, it's true. A postmodern pragmatism will differ from its modernist parent pragmatism only in being built on sand instead of straw. Both engage in the culture only to the degree that the how-tos of the Bible can be informed or replaced by secular how-tos. So when you hear cultural engagement by modernists or postmodernists, when you hear Rick Warren engaging in culture, Bill Hybels engaging in culture, versus Mark Driscoll engaging in culture, or Dan Kimball engaging in culture, what they mean by engaging in culture is a little skimmer on top of the pool to see what the kids are saying. That's not engaging in the culture. You're doing the easy work of holding up a mirror to people who are thinking very shallowly about what they're thinking about. And so the cultural exegesis of missional theology is always in danger of being either shallow or disingenuous. It'll be shallow when we're unaware of where that influence of culture on doctrine is actually more powerful than the best intentions of the missionary can withstand. And it'll be disingenuous when we intentionally ignore those questions, where that influence resides. So let's look at the gospel of missional theology. Missional theology makes a lot of creation as the picture in which the gospel is most clearly told by the people of God. The mission of God is spread through the church when the church shows the world the good news by transformed lives. We will show the world a better way to do relationships, a better way to do work and culture and child rearing. And in so doing, we will attract the unbeliever to Jesus, not primarily by speaking, but by being his good news people. Well, how does that work in other areas of church life? We tend to recognize that as legalism, when conservative suburban types do that, but not here. Now, it's true in the criticism that historic Calvinists sometimes, I would argue they're not historic Calvinists when they do this, have too often erred in starting our gospel at Genesis 3 instead of at Genesis 1 in terms of telling the story of God to the people, of what God was ultimately up to when he started the world. But it is not the case that Reformed theology errs in telling the story to the community by starting at Genesis 3, because that's where they start. In fact, we all start at the end of the day, if we're honest, we all start outside of the Garden of Eden looking in. And we risk communicating in our gospel a public works program that escapes the liberal social gospel of charity only by becoming a conservative social gospel of numbers. Both unbelievers and immature believers will be more apt to swarm to these public works activities of the church because these will be the activities that win the most applause with the culture. And we might appreciate a lot of their ingenuity when they put out leaflets like Belong, Then Believe, that program of mission. But we ought to be very careful that being and doing don't come to replace believing in how we understand how conversion occurs. What did Paul say twice in Galatians 3? How did the Spirit come to you in the first place? How does the Spirit mature you after that? By works of the law or by hearing with faith? Missional theology is on a collision course with the way the Bible says people get converted and therefore how the kingdom spreads. The Bible plainly teaches that the Spirit by the Word converts and grows the kingdom, and nothing else does. And so missional theology cannot be completely biblical if it does not create a cross-centered crisis in the souls of all who hear its message. But that's going to take a deeper understanding of what those reformers were saying about salvation. And part of what they were saying is that sinful human beings in culture are not very fond of the story being about God from A to Z. So it becomes a matter of life and death to make the explicit mission of the church all about bringing the sinner directly to the cross at all times, or else he will quickly and contagiously bring his sins to the mission. Christ saves somebody in order to put him on mission, true. But Christ will not stand for someone thinking that they will save themselves by that mission. And our message has to be careful to state that at every point. If the church is a missionary in a culture that's both hostile to and ignorant of the basic categories of thought, then it would seem imperative to make a study of that cultural context as much as the foreign missionary does about his. I have a lot of stuff here about what they're really saying when they say exegeting culture is something that Aristotle already said a long time ago about logos versus ethos. And really all the missionary that's doing that's obsessed with relevance is he's doing a little cultural bartering. He's basically trading with the culture. I'll say, I'll give you my logos, my truth, in exchange for yours if you'll give me a hearing. And that's ultimately what's doing. I have a whole section on that. Couple of really good quotes by David Wells about that, and one a good one by J. Gresham Machen, too, to point out that real cultural engagement goes deeper than these guys are talking about. It goes into the presuppositional culture, not just manifest culture. It conflicts, it combats, it doesn't just contextualize. But I've got to skip over all that stuff because we've got some time here that we have to get through. But this is, I think, what the leadership of even a lot of people in the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals are really letting slide and not being discerning about. There's this assumption here. There's a philosophy of disbelief that's just as strong as in the seeker leaders in that church. And the only difference is that the object of doubt has shifted from the fact of the truth to the scope and the efficiency of truth. And many people who have promoted missional theology have separated ecclesiology from soteriology on the grounds that there's no genetic relationship between them. This is what I talked about in the application on Sunday. These are people that are just kind of playing with Calvinism just to say that they're cool. And really, they're kind of assuming, well, if Calvinism is true, then what difference does Calvinism make? Because if Calvinism is true, then God does that. We don't do it. Why are we talking about it? That's dumb. It's taken care of. And so there's sort of a card trick at work here. Once you're in, you're in. And especially if you're a non-reflective Calvinist, like a lot of these church planters. If the doctrines of grace are true, then those that are saved, and now it's our mission to get on with the mission. The surer we are that Calvinism is true, the less it could possibly have anything to do with the spreading of the gospel. The doctrines of grace are translated into doctrines about why grace doesn't matter after all. And the inevitable consequence of this, there's two, is that this hip church planter and these hip church plants showing up in all areas of our nation, whose pulpits will now exposit this or that text on predestination, or definite atonement, or perseverance. They'll preach it the right way. They'll tell you, yeah, that's what it says. And then they'll rush to assure everyone that it doesn't really matter. It's okay. And another inevitable consequence is 5-to-1 missional Calvinistic gospel communities, every word of that's going to be in quotes, in cities all over our nation, set up by the devil to neutralize what would be a rush of 20s and 30-somethings to genuine Reformed revival in those areas. Those new to all this can't tell any different, and they'll surely flock to the ones that are cooler and nicer about it. But if such a recurrent theme in the Bible is so recurrently said not to matter, then one thing that these crowds will surely learn is that the persistent voice of God does not matter. It's also very likely that while we fiddle around with postmodernism, a more global reloaded materialism, such as we've been calling Enlightenment modernism, is going to be waiting with much institutional saliva and a very large fork and knife. Last point. We've all heard the story of the emperor who had no clothes. It's a children's story. New tailors are hired who promise the emperor new royal attire that is so dazzling that it's invisible to those who are unworthy, the benighted, those that are too stupid to see its radiance for themselves. And after much ado from the whole kingdom that was too afraid to admit what was staring them right in the face, it takes the profound simplicity of a child to pipe up and say, "But Mom, he isn't wearing anything at all." What then shall we say about this whole kingdom of naked madmen running through the evangelical church with their sparkling new missional gear? Do we break the awkward silence? Well, I've chosen to do that. After all, what is a gospel community, I always ask them, that a small group in a gospel-centered church is not? Well, it's a small group. That word's taken already. It's at home. Home fellowship group. It's the core, a core group? Well, it's the cell, like a cell group. Help me understand, what's different about a gospel community group, except that you don't read the Bible and you drink beer and kick your feet up and make fun of all the people that kick their feet up and talk about everybody else? But what's different about it, really? Help me understand that. Is it simply a rose by another name? Or is it only granted that rosy status by not being a tulip? The target of missional theology turns out to be a phantom menace. In fact, it turns out that the only thing missional theology is targeting phantom menaces. To be inwardly driven now is entirely a function of doctrinal seriousness. And so to be missional is against being doctrinally serious. In other words, at the end of the day, missional comes to mean only this: the degree to which we assure ourselves that we are not fundamentalists. What does it mean to be missional? It means to not be a fundamentalist. Whatever we do, God help us, let's not be fundamentalists like my father's church. Whether that self-assurance is expressed in an open creed or an open lifestyle, the new missional life is ironically a life of reaction. It is defined completely by what it is not. It is as reactionary and more so as fundamentalism ever was. The fundamentalism which it so detests. Biblical revelation is either understood on its own terms or not at all. Missional is not enough. The premise of postmodernism is that there are no such terms anymore, no meaning to words that stand above cultures. And aside from being a contradiction in terms that's very easy to expose, it is a suicidal deception for the church to say anything other than the truth claims that the Bible itself makes. Words still mean things, like it or not. And if the church persists in using the language of a culture that stands in opposition to the truth claims of Scripture, then the church will be wrong about the biggest things, even if it speaks it this way unwittingly. So in conclusion, the more ultimate reason why missional is not enough is because the act of horizontal mission in and of itself is not ultimate in God's mission. John Piper says it like this in his book, Let the Nations Be Glad. And I think this quote is my favorite corrective to missional theology. He says this: missions is not the ultimate goal of the church. Worship is. Missions exists because worship doesn't. Worship is ultimate, not missions, because God is ultimate, not man. Worship, therefore, is the fuel and goal of missions. It's the goal of missions, because in missions we simply aim to bring the nations into the white-hot enjoyment of God's glory. The goal of missions is the gladness of the peoples in the greatness of God. But worship is also the fuel of missions. Passion for God in worship precedes the offer of God in preaching. Missions begins and ends in worship. And so we come full circle in our study of doctrine division to the worshipful duty of doctrine. Because mission is rooted in worship, it is formally rooted in doctrine. The real truth about the next big division in church history is that it will be between those who care about doctrine and those who do not. And if any of what I've just written is true, then it will be between those who are serious about everything and those who are serious about nothing at all but their own reflection. Questions, comments, and tests.